Welcome. This is the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast with host Rob Giannino, where we have great conversation with really awesome experts from within the fly fishing community. You see, the fly fishing lifestyle is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us. Check out flyfishingjourneys.com for more podcasts, and please subscribe on your favorite podcast player. Here's your host, Rob Giannino.
Lou DeGenna is an accomplished fly tier from New Jersey. He's an extraordinary guy. We dive deep into fly tying, photography, digital media, and fine art. As I learned on this podcast, he is a professor of fine art and digital media at St. John's University. I don't think either of us thought we were going down the art rabbit hole, but that's the fun part about podcast. Learning about your guest as a person and about their expertise. It's clear Lou is an artist both behind the vise, behind the lens, and in various other art mediums. He stresses the idea of observation both in art and on the water, and how focused observation will make you a better fly tier and fly fisherman. We close with some of Lou's best tips for improving your fly tying and his favorite flies, dry, nymph, and streamer. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Angela with Cross Current Insurance. I manage our popular guide and outfitters insurance program. I've fished with guides in the U.S. and abroad, so I know the risks you face on and off the water. Our guide program provides liability coverage for your clients, boats, gear, and more. Plus, we donate a portion of our profits to industry nonprofit organizations, and you get to vote for who our donation goes to. So, whether you are a new guide or have been guiding for many years, check us out at crosscurrentinsurance.com. Tight lines.
All right, welcome to the next edition of the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Rob Giannino, and I'm super excited to have old friend Lou DeGenna on the podcast. Lou, thanks for being on with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rob.
Lou, now you are a fly tier from the New Jersey area.
Correct.
Tell our folks a little bit about where you're from and how long you've been fly tying.
I'm from New Jersey. Grew up in Newark and Irvington. Now live out by Clinton, New Jersey, by the Kenlockwood Gorge, which is probably one of our best trout streams in the state. Also got Spruce Run Reservoir nearby, which has hybrid striped bass, yep. Some tiger muskie.
What is your favorite style of fly fishing?
I like it all. Streamer fishing probably one of my favorite, but nymphing would be up there too.
You love nymphing?
Yeah. In New Jersey, we just don't have the hatches that they have out west. And when I go out west, I just want to only dry fly fish.
Yeah.
But New Jersey, you know, you nymph a lot, so.
When you're at the shows, you tell the listeners a little bit about what some of your go-to patterns are for fly tying.
Okay, so I have my Stonefly Creeper. It's Lou's Stonefly Creeper, which is a variation or derived from Jennings' Stonefly Creeper, which is a Catskill pattern.
Okay.
The pattern basically was yellow-orange dubbing, pheasant tails for the tails out the back, widgeon, which is a duck,
yep,
similar to teal barred duck feather, as the wing case over the top, and then grizzly hackle. Some of those materials are basically delicate, so I changed it up. But the first evolution of the pattern, I'd use flexi floss for replacing the pheasant tail. You started off with the dub body, a rabbit blend.
Yep.
I would then use thin skin for the shell back. Still use the grizzly hackle and made it a little bit more durable, but you know, the thin skin would pop out every once in a while. And so then when Solar Res came out, I started using that and markering up the back and giving a little bit of modeling and a little bit more dimension. And one thing about that pattern that I like a lot, it's two-tone. And whenever you're rolling rocks and picking up the bugs, you have a light side and a dark side. It's either that, you know, sort of olive yellow or an orange and dark brown or black, depending on the bug and the water.
Yeah.
And so you got to think when these insects get dislodged and are tumbling through the stream, that the fish see light, dark, light, dark. Mm-hmm. So they'll see a yellow, then a dark, and it'll flash. So I like doing two-tone flies whenever I get a chance. So, you know, using Solar Res, I can put it up top, hit it with a marker, give it the color I want on top.
Right.
And then the dub body on the bottom gives that natural color if you need to scrape it out for gills or anything like on a stonefly. And then as new materials come out, I modify it. So now I use Dirty Bug Yarn from Semper Fly. And it comes in a lot of different colors. It's on a spool. Makes the tying a little faster.
So this stonefly, do you find there's a lot of stones in the waters that you fish?
There are stoneflies in virtually every stream. And what's great about stoneflies is that there's usually a two-year brood. And so you'll have nymphs in the water year-round. It's not like, you know, let's say a Hendrickson hatch, where the bugs hatch in, depending on where you are, April time frame, early May, depending on where you are in the country. Then once they lay their eggs, the hatch is over, you have no nymphs. You have the eggs, and you have very small nymphs that, you know, are starting to develop. Whereas the stoneflies, they're typically two broods, sometimes three broods. And what happens is there are always stoneflies in the river. So anywhere you go in, anywhere in the country, as far as I'm concerned, if you didn't know what to throw, have a stonefly.
Interesting.
You know, because you can always have that stonefly. And one of the things I like when I'm nymphing is to have that stonefly take my other fly down and maybe, you know, have a blueing olive, a pheasant tail, or something else that's more local to that stream.
So you have that stonefly kind of rolling on the bottom.
Rolling on the bottom, but also taking down whatever it has with it.
Using it as weight.
Yeah, and it catches, so.
Yeah. So what was that name again of the one that you tied?
Mine is, I'm not very creative with the name there, just Lou's Stonefly Creeper.
Creeper?
Creeper, yeah.
What did you come up with a creeper for?
That's because it was named after Jennings Stonefly Creeper. So okay. I guess they called some of these nymphs creepers.
Yeah.
And the stoneflies, and that's a Catskill pattern. Art Flick had a version.
Okay.
You know, where he would have quill body and dubbing, similar kind of a widgeon feather over the top, same kind of materials.
Yeah.
They used what they had.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's like if they had solar res or if they had new materials, they'd use it.
Yeah. But they just used the feathers. I mean, I have a box of old fly tying material that I dug out of like my closet, and it's like, man, this stuff is just so basic. You know what I mean? It's not like today's materials, but it worked, you know? Yeah.
Well, think about the feathers with Ewing, Keoghan, you know, hackles. You know, get really fine mats. I mean, it doesn't matter who's you know, feather using. There's so much hackle on those feathers now compared to when, you know, a lot of these tires back in the day started. Whereas you had to use sometimes two or three feathers to hackle your fly.
Right.
And you used what you had, and you had more natural materials, and synthetics almost didn't exist.
Well, let's kind of go back in the day, Lou. So how long have you been tying?
35 years.
How did you start?
I started just looking in magazines, you know, as a kid. And I would see, you know, stuff tied in there. And I was like, oh, I was interested. And I did lure making when I was a young guy and just started making stuff. And I literally took feathers off of my dad's fedora.
Wow.
For the first fly I tied. And I didn't know, you know, I didn't know how to do the knots as far as a whip finish or a half hitch. You know, I'm just wrapping it on and just trying to figure out, like, how do I tie a knot? I didn't know what feathers I was using. They were just on my dad's hat. Now I know it's guinea fowl, you know.
Yeah.
But after that, I would say there was a big break in there because you just didn't have access to materials. And the sports stores I went to, as far as tackle shops, they weren't into, you know, fly fishing all that much.
Right.
And so there was more gear. It was more gear oriented. And so you didn't learn from those guys. You learned other stuff about fishing.
Sure.
But it was a TU class.
Okay, so that's where I was kind of getting to.
In 87, I took a TU class.
Okay.
Learned there. Learned the basics. Learned the tools, you know, what worked, what didn't work. Started with a Thompson A-Vice like a lot of people did, and you'll see them on eBay. You know, and it's a starter vice. You just don't know what to use.
And what was the driving force to kind of get you started? I mean, you said you saw some stuff in a magazine.
Yeah, well, as you're fishing, you know, your fishing journey, sort of, you start off spin fishing, bait fishing, going conventional gear, throwing plugs and whatnot, worms for plastic worms for bass and what. You know, and then you start saying, well, it's got to be something else. You sort of like, you mastered everything as you keep going, and you're like, I want a new challenge.
Sure.
And so that's where it really started. And part of that was I made my own rod. It was an old Fenwick yellow blank that was more for a spinning outfit, and it was fiberglass.
Yeah.
And bought a long handle to put on there with split rings so it could slide up or down so I could use it for a spinning rod and or a fly rod. And a lot of that early fishing was, all right, I'm just going to play and experiment, first catch fish with the spinning gear, then switch over to the fly rod. And it was, you know, about my mid-20s where I switched over to completely just fly fishing.
So you built your first fly fishing rod?
Yeah.
Wow. How did you, like, get into, like, how did you learn about how to build a rod?
That was just the library. You know, there was no internet.
Yeah.
You go to the library, there was books on how to make rods, and the tackle shops we go to, they made custom rods and stuff. So that was a wealth of knowledge there.
Yeah.
And so the guys would, you know, okay, what do I need? And you look it up, okay, and buy the silk, buy the thread, buy the guides, you know, from different places, and then use phone books to keep the tension on the thread, wrap them at the dinner table, and just do it slowly by hand, follow everything in the book.
That's amazing.
You know, then epoxy it.
And you hadn't even really truly started fly fishing yet.
Correct.
But you wanted to make your rod.
Yeah. Yeah. I had made other spinning rods before
that. Oh, you had. Okay.
Yeah. It was one of the things. You know, you made some money doing odd jobs around the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And you couldn't afford to buy an outfit, you know, and the outfits for a kid were expensive. So you start, oh, how much is the blank? Oh, I can do that. How much are the guides? I can do that.
That's cool.
You know, and just build stuff.
Are you still building rods today?
No, I stopped building rods a long time ago.
Yeah, just only so much time for fly fishing and then fly tying. I mean, you're tying a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, do you sell your flies or is this mostly just tying for enjoyment?
I do sell flies. Yeah. You know? Few customers, custom work.
Okay.
You know, at the shows, you know, you tie and people want to buy one or two. Great.
Yep. Sure.
But they contact me locally and, you know.
Well, I actually have an order for you because I was just talking with Jeff Currier.
Okay.
And I'm heading off to India at the end of March, early April. And he gave me some specifics and mostly just woolly buggers. And I tie them up myself. But for what I need, I was thinking about maybe asking you if you could tie some flies for me.
You could do that.
Like a custom order. I could put in an order with you.
Okay.
So what I'll need is some brown woolly buggers in various weights. So unweighted bead heads and some dumbbell eyes.
Right.
Because he says the woolly bugger is really one of the best flies to use for the golden masseur.
Okay.
That should be pretty easy for you, huh, the woolly bugger?
Woolly bugger's easy, but you want a durable, obviously.
I want a good one.
Yeah.
And so that's why I want to ask you to tie some for me.
Okay. We can do that.
Well, back to our regularly scheduled programming. We get the custom order out of the way.
There we go.
We're going to take a short commercial break to hear from Tim O'Neill of Norvice.
What makes the Norvice different than another system?
There are a lot of rotary fly tying vices out there. The Norvice is the only vice that will truly spin when you tie flies, and there's a big difference between rotating a vice slowly and spinning it at a bit of a faster RPM. And being able to spin the hook on a zero axis rotations opens up a lot of doors for us in the world of fly tying.
Tell me about the introduction of colors to the Norvice system.
When we obtained the company from Norm, he said to me just a very, very short statement. He said, you know, I always thought a colored Norvice would be a cool item. We brought out five colors: Radical Red, Sunset Orange, Shamrock Green, Liberty Blue, and Royal Purple. We have five colors along with the black that you're accustomed to seeing with Norvice, and we've been doing very well with those.
To find more information and their online store, visit nor-vice.com.
And, you know, maybe some other stuff, too. I'm talking to him, and we'll figure out. He also said some chubby Chernobyls. Do you chubby tie Chernobyl. Those?
I haven't. I usually buy them when I'm out west. You have to have something you buy when you go to a shop.
Yeah.
You know, you buy flies, get some information. And there are not a lot of shops, you know, and there are less and less. And if you go to box stores, they don't have anything.
Yeah, he said the other fly was the chubby Chernobyl.
Mm-hmm.
In, like, bright colors. In, like, orange, actually.
Orange is the now is the insect that's in the area prominently orange?
Well,
or is it just for the angler?
I think it's the attraction. He said he knew it because the masseur came up and grabbed like an orange bubblegum wrapper off the surface.
Okay.
And he's like, well, I'm going to put on something orange. And he had a big chubby Chernobyl dry in orange, and he got waxed. He said he caught fish the rest of the day.
There you go. Observation.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, that's why Jeff Currier is the best.
There you go. Well, that's one thing in fly tying, observation's big, I think. You know, looking at the bugs, doing stream samplings, seeing what looks like could be the trigger, as this is drifting down the stream, what's the characteristic that the fish is going to key in on?
Yeah.
When you're driving down the highway, if you see golden arches, you know exactly that's going to be a meal if you need it. Right. So what are those little cues that, you know, like I said, the two-tone, something flashing two-tone. But even if you throw a quote-unquote junk fly, let's say a mop, the mop's orange or chartreuse or whatever, which is maybe not natural in a sense of what's in the stream, but it's like curious. Oh, that's different.
Yeah.
Is that a high reward meal?
Right.
Or is it something I'm going to spit right out?
Right.
And the fish doesn't know. So it goes for it.
Well, it's funny you should say observation, because when I was just in Patagonia, like about a month ago, we were fishing for rainbows with streamers all day, but right at dark, they just started coming up, and I kept saying to my guy, I said, I think those are brook trout, because I could tell it looked like Maine at dark, you know what I mean?
Okay.
Like we couldn't even see in front of our face, But they were just, you could see them rising and rising and rising. We were casting, and we just figured, you know, they were on caddis at that point.
Right.
So we put on nice caddis, and we were trying to hit the circles, and we just weren't getting any takes. And these were big brook trout. I'm talking like 4 or 5 pounders.
Okay.
And we're throwing, and we just couldn't get one to take. And we got back to the, you know, the boat ramp. Like, it kind of started and ended pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a brook trout hatch would do at night in Maine or something like this.
Right.
And we got back to the boat dock, and we had our headlamps on now because we have to break down the boats and take off. And we looked down on the bottom of the boat was filled with beetles.
There you go. I had a similar story on the Madison. And you have all these Miller caddis flying across the water, you know, laying eggs, and, you know, fish are rising all over. And we just could not get them to take the caddis. They were on the midges that were in mixed with the caddis.
I hate the brook trout when they get on a fly like that. They just, you could make a beautiful cast with the wrong fly, and they're just not going to take it.
Right.
They're just on a specific fly.
Yeah.
And they were just crushing those beetles, man. And I was so upset because I wish I had put on a beetle. And my guide actually had a nice beetle invitation. It happened so fast, you know. And
right.
We didn't even notice to look down on the bottom of the boat because we would have saw all the beetles.
Yeah. But observation, is a key,
Yeah.
Pick up rocks when you're in the stream. Look, see what's there. You can use a little net that you can get at the pet store for an aquarium. You know, it doesn't have to be a big little kick seine.
Sure.
I do carry a little kick seine, and I do a little kick sampling just to see what's going on.
Sure.
And you look, and you see, oh, okay, there's more of this bug, more of that bug, and then you can play the numbers game.
For the listeners, what is your full-time career?
Yeah, I'm an art professor at St. John's University. I teach fine art and digital media.
That's amazing. Teaching fine art. How did you get into learning about fine art, for one, and then becoming versed enough to actually teach on it?
Well, I've been drawing since I was a kid. Always drew. Always did that. And I guess, what was it? I'm trying to think. First or second grade, I did a drawing in the class, and the teacher sent me down to the art teacher to show what I had done. And so that kind of gave me that little reward, like, oh, people like this.
Yeah.
And so I had always drawn. And when I went to school, I was originally going to go for architecture, but switched over to fine art, fell in love with printmaking, did a lot of that, worked in the industry for a while as far as graphic design work, then decided I wanted a little bit more and went back to school to get my master's and came across a digital media or digital art program at the School of Visual Arts. So I went there, got my master's. After that, started teaching.
So you got your undergrad where?
Uppsala College, or Uppsala.
Uppsala?
Right, in East Orange, New Jersey. They're no longer with us anymore. The college went bankrupt way back.
And then your master's?
At the School of Visual Arts.
In
Manhattan.
Manhattan?
Yeah.
Wow, that must have been cool.
Yeah, it was fun.
Going to college.
Getting your master's in your 20s in Manhattan. It must have been a wild time. It was a fun time.
You got that smile on your face. That's cool, man.
Yeah, the 80s were a nice time in the city.
Yeah. What was your first job out of college?
My first job was Gannett Advertising, doing paste-up mechanicals.
Okay. You got to cut your teeth somewhere.
Yeah.
So like at an ad agency?
Basically, yeah. I did a lot of ShopRite and Pathmark flyers.
Okay.
Back then, and it was paste-up mechanicals where you actually had things come off the typesetter.
Yep.
On a piece of film, and you would have pictures, and you would have all the stuff, and you would have the mock-up of what you had to do, and you would lay everything out, then send it over to the camera department so they could make the films for it and send it off to the printer.
I remember those times.
It was very labor. The whole process was very labor-intensive. Yeah. And that was pre-desktop publishing.
Wow.
So
you're almost antique, man.
Then I worked for Genographics, which was a computer graphics company doing slide presentations.
Yep.
And back when slide presentations also had big multimedia where you would have a bank of, let's say, 20 slide projectors, all computer controlled, you know, or from a big board, and they would flash and create little presentations that had animation and whatnot.
Right.
But it allowed everything to move from one slide to the other, opposed to just that click, 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 one slide coming in and out.
Sure.
You know,
And then how did you get into education from that type of career? What was your first job as a teacher?
First job as a teacher was at Parsons School of Design. I taught a class. One of my friends from graduate school said, Dean over at Continuing Ed is looking for people to teach computer graphics. So I went over, interviewed, and he gave me my first class.
And what about fine art? I mean, that's like a whole industry in of itself.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, in graduate school, I wrote software to basically take stuff out of the computer, get it into the real world, off the monitor. And so I wrote my own color separation software. Again, I was into printmaking, so I knew lithography. I knew how to make prints. And so did the color separation side, put that together, and got an exhibit in Soho.
Wow.
In the 80s. And that just kept going. You could do a little bit more. You build, you know, build projects. I heavy into photography.
Yep.
Go out, photograph, process it in the computer. This is early days, so Photoshop. I started with Photoshop in the beta version.
Wow.
You know, and now everyone uses Photoshop. Photoshop that, or now it's ChatGPT or
right
Midjourney?
Are you still using Photoshop?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Are you do all your photography of all your flies?
Yes.
What type of equipment do you use for photographing your flies?
I have a Fuji 100S.
Macro?
I use a macro lens, yeah. It's medium format.
Okay.
So it's the big 100 megapixel sensor. I had Nikons, Panasonics. Now I'm into Fuji.
What's the process of using like a medium format for taking pictures of with the macro lens of your flies?
Well, basically setting up the lights is the first thing. Usually you have a prop, piece of driftwood if you want, or if it's the vise. Getting the light, enough light so that you're going to get the depth of field. For the depth of field, you have your aperture. And if it's large, less stuff's in focus. If it's smaller, more stuff's in focus. And so, you know, you try to take care of that as far as you want to get as much light so that you can use a smaller aperture so you can get more in focus.
And okay.
Without doing focus stacking, there's all kinds of techniques.
Do you do focus stacking?
I try not to.
Okay.
But sometimes
do you want to keep it like more realistic, or is it work?
I like the drop off, and a lot of what I've done as far as my photography is like, well, how do you see? When I'm staring at you, you're perfectly in focus, but your banner is out of focus and the person behind you is out of focus. But when I'm looking, but then if I'm just generally scanning, everything's in focus.
Right.
Right. And so if you're looking at one thing up close, you can say, okay, that's in focus, and everything out of focus, quite natural.
So you like that bokeh?
I love bokeh.
Mm-hmm.
My first lens was a 50mm 1.2 for my Nikon.
Okay.
Which is a bokeh monster back then.
So explain the difference from medium format to like a regular traditional digital camera, like a 35mm camera or a digital
camera. Well, 35mm is that kind of standard as far as 1:2 as far as the aspect ratio, so like 1 inch up, roughly 2 inches across. You know, or should say on the diagonal, it's the rise and the run. And you have then medium formats, which can be 2.25 by 2.25, 6x7, and different sizes. So you would have bigger negatives. Bigger negatives mean more resolution.
Yep.
In the film world, right? And so if you did product photography, that was all done in medium format because they wanted the larger negative because they wanted really good detail for their clients.
Right.
Whereas if you think about everything you're shooting, 35 millimeters the de facto standard. But back when 35 millimeter first came out, you know, 4x5 was the standard for journalism. The big field cameras, handheld, but you know, field cameras and you know, or brownies and little box cameras,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing.
Ansel Adams,
yeah, you know, his first camera was literally a brownie, basically, you know, single use camera. That you bought the brownie, it was loaded with film. You take your pictures, send the camera back to Kodak, they process it.
The whole camera?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
It wasn't, you know, but, I mean, there were film that later on, but the first one was like those single-use cameras.
You take one picture?
No. You had a roll of film.
Oh, a roll inside that, but it was like the one time, like when you used to get those single-use cameras at CVS.
Yes, exactly. That they started that back when they first started the company.
Yeah.
How do you make it accessible to everyone?
So you've kind of studied all of those historians in all these fields.
Yeah. That's, you know, you like, going to art school, that's what you do.
Besides making, it's required.
besides making stuff. But a lot of that stuff I learned in art school, I use in fly tying. So when I said I use solar res and I color it with marker, and I actually layer the colors so it gives a little bit more modeled 3D effect, more for me or someone buying the fly. But it, you can say it's like, okay, that has something that looks like it's alive.
Yeah.
Even though I'm going for more impressionistic, you know, interpretations of it, I then layer the colors because in nature, color is layered. Nothing's like flat one tone.
Sure.
Right? It's a lot of things are translucent.
Right.
You know, when you learn how to paint flesh, you don't have, you know, you just get that one color, you know, paint out of the tube and paint flesh. Flesh is a lot of different colors. Light penetrates the skin and reflects back.
Sure.
So same thing happens, I think, with your flies. And you think about all your materials you're using. Why does one material work better than another material? Could be how the light transmits through it. And so in art, you know, when you're thinking about how you're going to paint or reconstruct the scene, you know, even if it's just in your mind, you're like, how is the light interacting with the medium? And
sure.
In this case, fur and feathers and now synthetics, light interacts and water interacts. And so some materials work better and some probably not.
Yeah.
And I think part of it's the play of light, but
right.
Also you have water and the tension in the water is like, does it breathe? Does it grab bubbles? You know, I would say my theory on CDC, the reason it works so great is not just that it floats really well, but I use it in my nymphs because it grabs bubbles. And all those little micro bubbles, when you do a sampling or take pictures or see underwater pictures of insects, typically they have a lot of bubbles attached to them. So is that a trigger for the fish?
Sure.
Right? Because light's coming through the water. It's hitting those bubbles, little rainbows.
I like
right?
that.
Little reflections, little glistening. And the fish says, oh, that's not a rock.
Mm-hmm.
Rocks don't glisten by themselves. Right? So
very cool.
I use that when I'm designing flies or thinking about what materials I'm going to use.
Yeah.
How am I going to layer color? And then how does it work in the water and in light?
Lou, stay right there. We're going to take a quick commercial break and we'll be right back. I've got a few questions for you about that fine art degree.
As our brand states, fly fishing is a journey. We've been so glad to share this journey with you. Some of you have even decided to join us on this journey as part of our fly fishing travel program. Whether it's Iceland for monster browns and Atlantic salmon, Alaska for Pacific salmon, Patagonia, the jungle, and many places around the world, we are here to help you fulfill your dream fly fishing destination experience. As part of our curated travel program, we can assist you with all the details and logistics and offer advice to help you catch your bucket list fish. As part of a hosted group or traveling on your own, we are here to help. Check out the travel section at flyfishingjourneys.com.
Okay, we're back here with Lou. And Lou, that question I had for you was, how did you transition from some of your teaching and some of the equipment to the fine art? Because, I mean, I'm fascinated with fine art, and I'm fascinated with art museums.
Okay.
So tell me a little bit about how you kind of went into the fine art aspect of what you do.
You're making work, and it's for yourself, right?
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, you're always making work for yourself first.
Yeah.
When people see it, they're like, oh, why don't you show it? And you start going to the galleries, finding galleries that have work that's similar to yours or hope that's similar to yours. And then you start talking to the people there and asking, you know, what was it take? Back then, you would take your slides. So your portfolio were basically, you know, little slides that you would have in a sleeve. And they would
yeah.
either hold it up to the light. And occasionally, they'd say, well, can you bring in the actual work? And you would bring in the actual, make an appointment.
Right.
Sit down with the gallery director and show them the work. And hopefully, they like it.
Right.
And figure that they had a market that they could sell it to. And that's it's just about meeting people. It's not too similar from, you know, the show here.
Mm-hmm.
You meet lots of people, show what you're doing, and then people like your work and either say, oh, do you have the recipe? Can I learn how to make it? Can I watch you make it? And then make it at home.
Yeah.
Or buy the product, whatever that may be, the fly. So
sure.
It's very similar. It's the same process.
Yeah.
It's networking, right?
Yeah.
Getting to meet people. Finding the people that have the same kind of visual sensibilities of you that you have, or like the same kind of fishing. So you got a lot of tires here that all have their own little, you know, niche.
Right.
Right, that they like to do because this is what they like.
Sure.
Right? Because they're tying for themselves first. So it's a similar thing.
Do you have certain artists or periods of time that you like better than others when it comes to the fine art?
A little bit all over the place.
Yeah, my favorite is Van Gogh.
Van Gogh's very good. Yeah, I like Van Gogh.
And I was actually able to go to the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam.
Yeah. I remember when MoMA had his big retrospective, went there three times.
Have you been to any of these fine art museums like Van Gogh or even in Manhattan?
Oh, yeah. Again, art school.
Yeah.
So Guggenheim, the Met, Museum of Modern Art, been out to, Chicago to the museums there, Austin, L.A., anytime you're there, it's like, okay, I'll go to the museum and
so
take
a
look.
So do you do that when you travel, like, to a big city like that that has nice museums? Is that, one of the things
it's
on
one
your...
of the things on my list, yeah, to do.
Hit the museum.
I used to travel more for the university.
Okay.
And I would always fit that in. And to answer your question, I'd say I like Sargent a lot, John Sigler Sargent. I like a lot of the stuff in the Hudson River School.
Okay.
Photography, Ansel Adams is, up there because I love landscape photography.
Yeah.
And that's another reason to have the medium format camera.
Yeah, I love Yosemite, and so that's kind of how I fell in with Ansel Adams. Fell in love with Ansel Adams is that I loved Yosemite. I loved his work that he used to do along the John Muir Trail and like all that kind of beautiful black and white stuff.
Yeah, and all his stuff go back to light. It gets to light. Everything's about the light. And if you think about it, if you have a bluebird day, is it as exciting as if you have some weather, right? And the light's constantly changing. And a lot of times you're chasing the light. And you go to Van Gogh, basically painting, it was all about the light. One of the quotes about, I can't remember which impressionist painting was, it's all about the light. That's all I'm trying to capture is the light, the fleeting light.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they would paint, all plein air, in the fields, just to capture that quality of light.
Interesting.
Right? And paint it as quickly as they can. Which was in response a little bit as far as impressionism from photography, because now that you had this new tool, the photograph, the daguerreotype, that could record the world very accurately, even though it was maybe in black and white, it really recorded the world accurately.
Yeah.
And so, painters was like, well, if I'm going to lose this commission work for portraiture, right, because you have photography, which is very accurate and very quick and almost immediate, compared to sitting in a chair and having the painter paint you come from session to session, because there was no way of recording you other than maybe some sketches, and sitting down and having that portrait done in paint, that in response to that, when photography came out, because it was this new reproduction of the world that was very accurate for that time, right? It was cutting edge to paint, and it's like, oh, well, what are we going to do? Well, we're going to chase light, and we're going to paint how light is, and how fast can we paint it? And so the gesture comes in. Van Gogh, very, impasto as far as heavy brush strokes. You see his strokes, and some people working very big, very small, and quickly, right? Getting more gesture and that quality of light.
Well, they do say, like, even photography, the golden hour,
Just there's the golden hour, the blue hour, and you get up early.
Is that the morning one?
Your golden hour is, the hour before sunrise and the hour before sunset. Blue hour is just after the sun's gone over the horizon, and you have still some reflection that will hit the clouds. So, sun's gone down, you notice it's still golden, then it goes a little gray, and then it pops.
Blue. Yeah.
And that's just the reflection.
Interesting. Yeah, because I saw that down in Patagonia. It was right before. At a different night, we were there fishing after dark, and it just gets like that blue sky.
Yeah. And that's beautiful.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite even fly fishing museum? Do you go to any of the museums, whether it be in Roscoe or the American Museum of Fly Fishing, which I think is in Vermont?
Yes, I've been to the one in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
The one in Vermont.
Yep.
And one in Roscoe area.
Might be Livingston Manor. I'm not exactly sure.
It is Livingston Manor.
Yeah.
On the Willowmilk.
Yeah. Have you been over there?
Oh, yeah.
The Catskill Museum.
I'd say Catskill's my favorite.
It is.
Well, but I'm a Northeast guy. I'm New Jersey, so New York's closer. Pennsylvania, a little further away. Vermont, I'm a lowlander. I'm not,
So tell me, what is it like over at the American Museum of Fly? I'm not the American Museum, but the Catskill Museum.
It has all the Catskill tires, all set up. I haven't been there in a while, but, all the Catskill tires, mock-ups of different people's tying areas.
Mm-hmm.
Lee Wolf, again, as a kid, what did you have? The American Sportsman. And you had Kurt Gowdy and Lee Wolf on television as a kid.
Was that some of your people who kind of inspired you?
Yeah, Yeah.
Those guys?
Yeah, absolutely. They were just, you know, Saturday morning after the cartoons, there were fishing shows, and it was the American Sportsman. And so you got a sampling of a little different things. And if you didn't have an activity that day, you're just sort of in your pajamas, just still watching, you know, TV.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that was it for me, too. It was Walker's Cave Chronicles.
Yeah, that came later, and
Yeah, and it was The Spanish Fly, Jose Wahebe.
Right.
I used to love Jose Wahebe. Actually got a chance to meet him at the old Wilmington show not far from here.
Nice.
And he signed, it was like a bonefish, black and white, that he was had at his booth or his table. And you'd buy it, and then he would, you know, autograph it for you and sign it. I used to love Jose Wahebe. I thought he was the truest form of a fisherman because he would do that morning show, and he would just catch the pilchers with his throw net, in that you throw and you catch your pilchers, and then he would take that, and he'd put it on a spinning hook, and he'd spin fish, and he'd catch something a little bit bigger.
Right.
Then he'd take that, and then he'd go catch a bigger fish, and then he'd take out his fly rod, and he'd go catch some fish on his fly rod. So he was just a, you know, Floridian, and he'd be down in Florida on his boat, and he'd have his bare feet and his jeans with his jeans rolled up. I mean, he was just a cool guy.
Yeah. Well, it's we could go back to observation, read your environment, learn what's happening in your environment. Just, you know, just take a second and look.
Yeah.
And just say, okay, what's changing? What's not? What's going on here? Just 5 minutes.
Yeah.
That's all it takes.
Just don't just rush off into the water.
Don't rush off into the water. You know, and see, like, okay. But be observant all the time. And I think that's one of the attractions of fishing in general, is that you're always in the moment.
Yeah.
You're tracking your flies. You know, you're tracking your lure, whatever it is. You're in direct contact with it if you're manipulating it as a streamer, right? If you're fishing it and you're getting it to swim. And, you know, what is the behavior you're trying to imitate? Wounded fish, fish fleeing, you know, prey fish.
Yeah.
And then if you're catching the bait fish, and you see how the food chain works, observation again, it's like, oh, they eat this, so if I'm going to tie a fly, I need it to at least have some characteristics that are close to that forage that they're going after.
Got a couple questions for you before we close. Number one, what would be some of your top tips in today's fly tying world that you could pass on to somebody who maybe hasn't tied as long as you? What would be some of the top tips or some things to think about when tying flies?
Thread tension is the number one rule. It's like you can almost say, what are the three rules in real estate? Location, location, location. Fly tying, first foremost, thread tension. And thread tension, as far as even thread tension all the way around as you go. And then focusing on, like, when I am going around, what is the material doing? Am I pushing it so that way, wrapping it around the hook? If it wraps around the hook, then I have a lot of thread torque and I got too much pressure. Knowing when to ease up so you can catch the material, and then when to apply that pressure, right? But not have it loose, and never go loose. Because once you go loose, you can unwind, right?
Yeah.
And having good constant thread tension and consistent thread tension means even if you break your thread, 9 times out of 10, it won't unravel on you.
You can save it.
Yeah, you can save it. Just go in, even when catch it again, and not have to worry about everything coming apart.
Okay. Thread tension.
Thread tension, throw half hitches to save your work, you know, as a beginner.
It's like hitting save on the computer, huh?
Exactly. Well, but as a beginner, you know, thread tension, first thing, half hitch is a real easy knot. Just throw in one half hitch anytime you're going to take a break or you're going to change materials, you're going to change a step, but to save what you've done, your progression at this far, glue would be another thing. You know, use glue sparingly and use the adhesive that works for that. You know, I know a lot of people love Solar Res. I love Solar Res, but it's not for everything.
Yeah. Well, that was what I was going to ask you before we get to the final question. What are some of the companies or manufacturers that you're either a pro staff of or recommend?
Regal Vice, Solar Res, Ewing Hackle, and then A-Rex Hooks.
Let's talk about the hooks. Yeah. What do you like about A-Rex?
They're making quality hooks.
Yep.
And getting feedback from fly tiers of what they want in a hook and are then designing those hooks.
So like sharpness and
sharpness,
quality steel.
Good temper.
Don't break.
don't break. I mean, I have a lot of old stock of old classic hooks for certain classic wet fly patterns.
Yeah.
And, you know, you use those for shadow boxes. But then when it's fishing flies, biggest thing is the temper of the hook. It's not going to bend out on you. It's okay. Not going to break. And it's consistent. The hooks are consistent. So yep. When I go and I buy a, you know, 100 pack of hooks on a Monday and I go, you know, a year from there and buy another 100 pack of hooks, they're going to be exactly the same. There's not going to be any variance.
So you like the A-Rex?
I do like the A-Rex a lot.
Before we close, one three-part question. Favorite dry, favorite streamer, favorite nymph. We'll start with your favorite dry.
An Iris caddis. So, you know, Craig Matthews pattern. Favorite streamer.
First of all, I'm not going to let you off that easy. Why is it your favorite dry?
There are caddis on all the streams. It's dry fly fishing, which is great, and fish in the evening are always on them.
Why do you like the Iris?
It's an impressionistic pattern. It has a little shuck. It has Zeelon wings, so it reflects a little bit of that evening light or, you know, late day light.
Okay.
And so it's got, and it sits low in the surface film, so it has a good impression as far as its footprint.
Do you tie this one?
Yeah, I tie it for myself.
Yep.
I mean, there are plenty, you can go out to plenty of shops and get it. And
yep, that sounds good. All right, your favorite nymph?
My favorite nymph, I would say Sawyer's pheasant tail nymph.
A Sawyer's pheasant tail.
Yeah, I'm not including any of my own in this selection. I really love Sawyer's pheasant tail nymph. His killer bug could also fall in that because, you know, his fly tying was he kept everything simple.
Yep.
And just put on there what you needed to get the job done. And I try to mimic a lot of that or use a lot of that philosophy as far as keep it simple, stupid in some of my fly tying. You know, take away things. You can always add things. But at a certain point, you want to tie the night before you're going to go fishing.
Yeah, you got to get some bugs on the,
you know, guide fly style. You know?
Yeah. Favorite streamer?
Favorite streamer. I'd say a Barn Special.
Isn't that a main pattern?
That's a main pattern. Yeah, for a landlocked salmon.
The landlocked salmon.
Yeah, smelt imitation.
Very cool.
There's something about that. It just always works, and it's a great pattern.
And you love to fish in Maine.
I do love to fish in Maine.
And we won't tell people where you love to fish in Maine. I mentioned the name of the word on Bart's podcast, and I got a dirty look. The name of the river.
It's a well-known river in Maine. That's all I'm going to tell you.
Well, go back and listen to Bart's podcast. If you want the name, you have to listen to two podcasts.
Yeah.
You'll get the name. I got a dirty look when I mentioned the name.
There are people in the show today who guide on the river.
Yep.
That I like fishing for landlocked salmon.
Fantastic. Oh, we already told them the species.
So we told them the species before that because Barn Special is a smelt pattern.
Yeah.
And landlocks and Atlantics all like to eat smelt and follow the smelt in, right?
You can figure it out from there. Go listen to the podcast with Bart. You can find out the name of the river.
Yeah.
Well, Lou, it's been an absolute blast having you on. How can our listeners get a hold of you and just stay in touch with what you're up to?
I have a blog page, Fly and Fin, but I would say the best way is on either Instagram, LouDG13. Same Fly and Fin on Facebook.
Very cool.
If you just do Fly and Fin on Facebook or LouDG13 on Instagram, you'll find me.
Well, man, thanks for spending a few minutes with us.
Thank you.
It's been a blast learning about all your photography and your painting.
Yeah, I didn't know we were going to go into the yard end.
I didn't know either. I actually didn't know this part about you, but it was great to learn about it. And thanks for sharing your tips with us.
All right. Great.
You've been listening to Fly Fishing Journeys with your host, Rob Giannino. To be notified of new episodes, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts. You can follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. For past episodes, check out flyfishingjourneys.com. Fly fishing is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us.